WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today is Monday, July 10th. Paul Dragoo is on vacation today, and I'm your substitute host, Steve Bonta. Our lead story today is about a man whose name few will recognize, but who could potentially topple the Biden presidency if, and that's a big if, he's able to testify. Gal Luft, the Israeli academic who has ties to the Biden family and the Chinese energy company CFC, and knowledge of the Biden's corrupt dealings with communist China, refuses to be silenced by Biden's thugs from the Justice Department. Back in 2019, Luft cooperated with Justice Department investigators looking into Hunter and Joe Biden's corrupt dealings with Chinese company CFC in an interview held in Brussels. After Biden was elected president, he tried to lay low, not wanting to be persecuted by Biden's vindictive minions who have been waging lawfare against many of Biden's political enemies, especially, of course, Donald Trump and anyone associated with him. But right after Republicans took control of the House late last year, with the prospect of congressional investigations into the Bidens, the DOJ suddenly took action, issuing an arrest warrant for Luft and prevailing on the government of Cyprus to seize him pending extradition hearings. The charges? Well, the mild-mannered academic and D.C. think tank executive director was alleged to be an arms trafficker and an unregistered foreign agent. Luft, however, seeing how the Bidens have been treating Trump and his associates, decided not to play ball and managed to abscond from the cottage in Cyprus where he was being kept under house arrest. After he failed to appear in court in Cyprus back in March, police investigated and found his vehicle abandoned not far from the airport. It has emerged that congressional investigators very much wanted to interview Luft, but were denied opportunity after he disappeared. Now Luft has reappeared, issuing a video from an undisclosed location alleging a systemic campaign of character assassination and false charges by the Biden Department of Justice. The video was sent to the New York Post and is a powerful witness in support of the massive evidence against the Bidens already assembled by the House Oversight Committee. So let's watch a bit.
My ordeal goes back to a fatal decision I made in March of 2019 to share with the U.S. government my knowledge about the Biden family's relations with CFC. As I said, it was in March of 2019 in a two-day session at the U.S. Embassy in Brussels. I insisted that the meeting take place in March because at the time there were rumors that Joe Biden was planning to run for president. I saw it as my civic duty to alert the government beforehand and give it enough time to probe the issue. I want to be clear. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I have no political motive or agenda. I did it out of deep concern that if the Bidens were to come to power, the country would be facing the same traumatic Russia collusion scandal, only this time with China. Sadly, because of the DOJ's cover-up, this is exactly what happened. After Brussels, I never heard back from the DOJ. But instead of showing appreciation for my whistleblowing, I became public enemy number one. Over the past 4 years that followed, me, my family, my friends, my associates, were all harassed, intimidated, and finally, I was prosecuted. Despite all that, on the eve of the 2020 elections, I sent my lawyer to Washington to meet with then acting Deputy Attorney General, Mr. Richard Donahue, to ensure he was informed about the information I had given his department in Brussels 19 months earlier, and also to warn him that there may still be a mole within the DOJ. Mr. Donahue confirmed to my lawyer that he was aware of my claims, but now we learn from the IRS whistleblower that it was Rich Donahue himself who suspended the investigation a few weeks earlier on September 4th, 2020, on the grounds that it was, quote, too close to the elections. Finally, in February this year, I was arrested in Cyprus on an extradition request from the Southern District of New York the very same office that met with me in Brussels. The seven-count indictment said I violated the Arms Export Control Act, and if I convicted, I would face up to 100 years in prison. While I was detained in Cyprus, I was portrayed in the international media as an arms dealer, even though I never traded a bullet in my entire life. In fact, nowhere in my indictment the DOJ claimed or presented evidence that I bought, sold, shipped, or financed any weapons. I was also charged with acting as an unregistered agent of CFC, which is a FARA violation. The DOJ says that I caused a payment of $6,000 a month to former CIA Director James Woolsey in order to put his name on an article I had ghostwritten for the China Daily newspaper. Nowhere in the indictment, the DOJ mentioned the well-known fact that Mr. Woolsey had been an advisor to my think tank since 2002. And that there was nothing in the article that represented Chinese interest. To the contrary, the notion that I, Gal Luft, spoon-fed a CIA director with policy proposals on China, treating him like a useful idiot, is not only an insult to the intelligence community, it is an insult to the intelligence of every American.
Okay, so after accusing the DOJ of naked political intimidation, Luft challenged them to make the charges and evidence against him public. So let's just watch a little bit of that.
So let me propose an idea. Why won't the DOJ make my indictment public? Do it. Make my day. Put it on your website so that every American can see the nature of the allegations against me, the quality of the evidence, and the length the government is willing to go to weaponize the justice system to punish whistleblowers like me. I have another idea. Why won't the FBI submit to Congress the minutes from the Brussels meeting? Let everybody see what happened in Brussels. Why not? Are you trying to protect anything? Are you trying to protect anybody? I also hope that the DOJ can explain why they targeted me in Cyprus and not in my home country of Israel, where I reside most of the time. After all, the U.S. shares a bilateral extradition treaty with Israel. So if any of my crimes are real and serious, and this is not just political prosecution, why did the U.S. need to sneak up on me during a short visit to Cyprus? Do they not trust the Israeli judicial system to judge this issue on its merits? What's going on here? Also, why did the DOJ wait 6 whole years, well beyond the statute of limitation, to indict me? And why did the DOJ choose to unseal the indictment on November 1st, 2022? The very same week of the midterm elections? Could this have anything to do with the fact or the fear that once Republicans gain control over Congress and begin to investigate, their cover-up would be in full display? And perhaps the biggest question of all, why am I being indicted for FARA, for ghostwriting an innocuous article for which I received no payment, let alone from a foreign government, when the mother of all FARA cases, the Biden systemic influence peddling on behalf of foreign governments for which they raked millions, goes unpunished?
Luft explained that he chose to flee Cyprus and go into hiding because he had no expectation of a fair trial in the United States. And he explained why.
This is, in a nutshell, why I decided to act the way I did. Because I do not have faith that I would receive a fair trial in a New York court. Let me tell you why. CFC Secretary General Dr. Patrick Ho, who paid Hunter Biden $1 million for God knows what, was not allowed to mention the word Biden before the jury when he was tried in New York in 2018. The very same prosecutor who is now after me, Daniel Reichenthal, told the judge at the time that mentioning the name Biden would, quote, add a political dimension to the case. And the judge agreed. Which means that if I'm ever brought before a U.S. court, I would not be allowed to utter the word Brussels or Biden. And the real context of my arrest, me being patient zero of the Biden family investigation, would be hidden from the jury. Let it sink in. I, who volunteered to inform the U.S. government about potential security breach and about compromising information about a man vying to be the next president, am now being hunted by the very same people whom I informed and may have to live on the run for the rest of my life. I warned the government about potential risk to the integrity of the 2020 elections. If convicted by a U.S. court, would never be able to vote again in the U.S. elections. Just think about it and ask yourself, who's the real criminal in this story?
Well, the lesson from Luft's story is clear. Inform on the deep state and its corrupt operatives at your peril. Mr. Luft, who is the most important of all the whistleblowers and witnesses against the Biden crime family, has been turned into a fugitive and an outcast by an administration willing to go to any length to hide its corruption and crimes. Meanwhile, in Brazil, the Marxist tyranny of Lula da Silva is deepening. Lula is now determined to purge Brazil of every vestige of the influence of his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro. Right after being sworn into office, Lula reversed all of Bolsonaro's gun policies that had relaxed firearms restrictions in Brazil. In February, Lula suspended the issuance of gun permits and gave Brazilians who had acquired firearms until May 3rd to register them. He also reversed the privatization of 10 government-owned companies that Bolsonaro had tried to privatize. He has unleashed a ferocious assault on internet freedom, supporting a new law which, if passed, will force tech companies to remove all news deemed fake or face heavy fines. And now, Lula has made sure Bolsonaro cannot challenge him again at the ballot box. Last Friday, Brazil's Superior Electoral Court ruled by a 7-5 majority that Bolsonaro cannot run for office again for 8 years. His crime? Abuse of power and spreading immoral and appalling lies during last year's electoral campaign. In other words, Lula has done to his opponent and supporters precisely what Biden and the Democrats are trying to do to Donald Trump, who is, incidentally, a friend of Bolsonaro. Now, Bolsonaro's political career has effectively been ended by the lawless radical left that has taken power in Brazil. This time, they hope, for good. Okay, well, with me today is Gary Benoit, editor-in-chief of the New American Magazine. Well, Gary, what did you think of the Gal Luft story, the latest intrigue? We've been following that story now for several months, but this 13-minute video is just a bombshell.
It sure is. I watched the entire video, and of course, everyone should do so. But it really is extraordinary that despite the sacrifices, despite even putting one's life on the line, that there are people who are willing to step forward. There are people who are willing to testify and to do the right thing, to exercise one's civic duty. Although I think that is putting it mildly, Steve, because really what we're talking about is saving the American Republic, saving our freedoms.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we shouldn't make too much of it in the sense that, I mean, Gal Luft is not necessarily a good guy. He does admit, for example, in the video, that he wrote an op-ed for the Chinese Communist Party's daily newspaper. He's clearly sympathetic to some degree with the Chinese government. So he's not, you know, there are not really any good guys in the larger Biden saga. There are simply some who are willing to turn, you know, to roll, as it were, and others who are digging in and assuming that this will all pass and they'll get away with it, they and their ill-gotten gains. So, you know, but Luft does come across as being, very, very believable. Certainly, you know, wherever he is in hiding, he has no particular incentive to come out.
And of course, human beings can be very complicated.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They sure can. But I just see in this person, I could be wrong, but I just see that he is somebody who wants to try to expose what is going on. even if it means that he has to be hiding for the rest of his life.
Yeah, I mean, if there's a common feature and a common thread in these two stories, it's how the radical left steamrolls anyone that stands in their way, be there a president of a powerful country like the United States or Brazil, or a lowly academic or think tank nerd who happens to have critical information that threatens their whole, you know, international house of cards.
And of course, the connection between Brazil and the United States, or I should say the parallels, are extraordinary, because I could see the day coming where somebody like President Trump may not be allowed to run for re-election. In fact, may even be put in jail. That's certainly what the insiders want.
Well, yeah, and I mean, nominally, Brazil is a federal republic, the same as the United States. But in practice, obviously, many of their laws are far more vaguely written. And so, there are not as many checks and balances, which is why they were able to do effectively exactly what Biden and company would love to be able to do yesterday to Donald Trump. You know, in effect, you know, cut him, you know, kneecap him, make sure he could never run for office again. And they may yet succeed in doing that, but... You know, in the meantime, obviously, there's still some legal process still, some, you know, due process and all the rest of this that protect Trump. There are a number of obstacles which don't seem to exist in Brazil. Stay tuned, folks, because when we come back, we're going to be talking about President Biden's decision to provide cluster bombs to Ukraine.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
Welcome back. The Biden administration announced on Friday that it will be providing Ukraine with thousands of cluster bombs as part of an $800 million aid package. The controversial weapon opens midair to release scores of smaller bomblets over a much wider area that would then be hit by a single bomb, thereby increasing the likelihood of causing injury and death to civilians. Also, a certain percentage of the bomblets do not immediately explode, resulting in dangerous duds that could prove to be lethal on a short time or long afterward. This is why over 100 countries have agreed to a treaty prohibiting the use of cluster bombs. The United States is not a party to this treaty. However, in the past, the Biden administration has condemned the use of cluster bombs by Russia. In February of 2022, then White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki referred to Russia's use of these bombs as potentially a war crime.
Thanks, Jen. There are reports of illegal cluster bombs and vacuum bombs being used by the Russians. If that's true, what is the next step of this administration, and is there a red line for how much violence will be tolerated against civilians in this manner that's illegal and potentially a war crime?
It would be. I don't have any confirmation of that. We have seen the reports. If that were true, it would potentially be a war crime. Obviously, there are a range of international fora that would assess that. So certainly we would look to that to be a part of that conversation.
Again, that was more than a year ago. The Biden administration is now going to be providing Ukraine with these munitions, and in so doing is further interjecting the United States into a proxy war that could blow up into a much larger war as a result of our increasing involvement. On Friday, the same day the Biden administration announced it would be sending cluster bombs to Ukraine, The New American interviewed U.S. Senator Ron Johnson about a variety of subjects, including Ukraine. Cluster bombs were not mentioned in the interview, but Senator Johnson did warn against saber-rattling and beating the drums of war. We will show you what he had to say about Ukraine later in our program today. Well, last week, Americans celebrated the birth of our nation on July 4th, Independence Day. The events and festivities included parades, backyard barbecues, and fireworks. And properly so, since America's Declaration of Independence, followed 11 years later by the Constitution of 1787, bestowed upon us the greatest blessings and liberty the world has ever seen. As Americans, we have much to celebrate and much to be thankful for. But as we know, not everyone was in a celebratory mood regarding our wonderful heritage of freedom on July 4th. Consider the woke ice cream company Ben & Jerry's, which picked July 4th of all days in the year to send out the following tweet, quote, "This 4th of July, it's high time we recognize that the U.S. exists on stolen indigenous land and commit to returning it. Learn more and take action now," unquote. The link provided in Ben & Jerry's tweet elaborates, quote, "Ah, the 4th of July. Who doesn't love a good parade, some tasty barbecue, and a stirring fireworks display? The only problem with all that, though, is that it can distract from essential truth about this nation's birth. The U.S. was founded on stolen indigenous land. This year, let's commit to returning it. Here's why we need to start with Mount Rushmore," end quote. Mount Rushmore? Yes, that's where Ben & Jerry's want to start. The company claims that, quote, "the faces on Mount Rushmore are the faces of men who actively work to destroy indigenous cultures and ways of life," unquote. However, here's an alternative idea. If Ben & Jerry's sincerely believes that America was founded on stolen indigenous land and that this land should be returned, then why not start with the land its own headquarters occupies in Vermont? At least, that is what one Indian chief is interested in doing. According to a Newsweek article, quote, "An indigenous tribe descended from the Native American nation that originally controlled the land in Vermont, the Ben & Jerry's headquarters is located on, would be interested in taking it back," its chief has said, after the company publicly called for stolen lands to be returned. Don Stevens, chief of the Nulhegan Band of the Kusuk Abenaki Nation, one of the four descended from the Abenaki that are recognized in Vermont, told Newsweek it was, quote, "always interested in reclaiming the stewardship of our lands," unquote, but that the company had yet to approach them. Final close quote. Gee, I wonder why not. Is Ben & Jerry's insincere about giving back the land? What do you think, Gary?
I think the question speaks for itself.
Yes, well, possibly so. The issue that you encounter again and again with these sorts of woke stories is that it's always wokeness for thee and not for me.
I know.
Or perhaps better put, maybe selective wokeness.
Or maybe it's
and
a good
moral indignation.
But maybe possibly. Not. Maybe Ben & Jerry's would be very happy if Mount Rushmore was defaced and the faces on the mountain actually removed.
I don't really understand their marketing strategy, because it seems to me that Ben & Jerry's has already pretty much saturated the wokester and granolas market, which is not really a majority market, and they ought to be aiming instead for larger markets. But it just goes to show the hypnotic power of ideology, particularly leftist ideology.
It really does.
Yeah. I was talking with someone on the radio, an interview earlier today, and that had that very question. Why is that companies so consistently seem to be willing to put profits, put ideology and politics in ahead of profits? We see this. We've seen this again and again, particularly in recent months. I don't know the answer.
Well, we've seen it with big box department stores, for example.
Mm-hmm. And Bud Light, of course.
Yeah, and Bud Light.
Sure.
Yeah, and I think there is an explanation for it, and it's the fact that the fix is in at the top, because it's not just a case of making a profit. It's a case of the assault on our entire civilization to try to remake America, to try to make all of America woke. But, of course, the American people are not going along with it, and that's the good news. And I should mention one thing, too, Steve, because we're talking about Ben & Jerry's and the stand that they took on the 4th of July. But something else very significant happened on the 4th of July as well. And this, of course, is very good news. It's a wonderful thing. And that is the release of the movie, The Sound of Freedom, starring Jim Caviezel. And the success of that movie has been absolutely extraordinary, Steve.
So has the backlash.
Yeah, and the backlash, too. It was an independent film. It was released by Angel Studios. And it has exceeded all expectations. As of Sunday, from July 4th up until Sunday, it has taken in $40 million at the box office. And as you mentioned, Steve, the backlash, because until very recently, the movie was largely ignored. And all of a sudden, the major media is no longer ignoring it, but they're talking about it as the QAnon movie. One media organ after another is saying it. It's like they've compared notes, so to speak. It's like they're all following the same script.
Yeah. Well, and we've talked about the movie previously in the show, and, probably not to get too far afield, but usually the rule of thumb is whenever the left stridently protests, you know, fluff up their feathers in righteous indignation about this issue or that, it's because they're doing the thing in question that they're accusing other people of doing. You know, we're seeing this in spades, of course, with the Biden scandal vis-a-vis Trump and so forth and so on. But anyway, I just wanted to talk for a moment about the cluster bomb controversy. Cluster bomb is one of those terms that sounds very scary on the face of it. But of course, you know, all bombs do terrible damage. Cluster bombs are not illegal. The United States and Russia both are not signatories to this treaty. So, you know, I mean, the morality of it aside, we and they are not treaty bound not to do this. One of the issues that's been mentioned in the press is that, well, Russian cluster bombs are much, much less reliable, meaning that those delayed fuse bomblets that fall on the ground have allegedly up to a 40% non-detonation rate, because they're supposed to fall and detonate, you know, pretty quickly after the, but some of them don't. They just lie there like, you know, old landmines waiting to take off some little child's leg a decade later.
Could say they're duds.
Right.
But they're very dangerous.
They still have
the ability to explode at any time.
Yeah, whereas the U.S. cluster bombs allegedly are more reliable, though still obviously, you know, there's potential. So I don't know what the answer is, except that clearly we're involved way, way, way over our heads in the Ukraine war.
That's part of it. And it's interesting, too, how the narrative on the part of the Biden administration has changed, because in the past they were against the use of cluster bombs, and now we're providing these same weapons that they were against using to Ukraine.
Right. And ironically, we just announced with great fanfare that we destroyed the last of our chemical weapons stockpile. So now we're going to wage war in a completely moral fashion. Well... Anyway, on the other side of the break, we will hear what Senator Ron Johnson has to say about the war in Ukraine. Remember, for more truth behind the news, make sure to get a subscription to the New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com or by calling our office at 800-727-8783, Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S. Unknown agents from around the world using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of Control, Immigration Invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.
Welcome back. On Friday, my very able colleague Paul Dragoo took time off from his vacation to interview U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. In the interview, Johnson expressed his admiration for the Ukrainian people, but he also said, quote, "We need to stop saber-rattling, stop beating the drums of war," unquote. Let's watch.
Listen, I was chairman of the European Subcommittee on Foreign Relations. I've been to Ukraine a number of times. I have a lot of respect for the Ukrainian people who want what we have. Okay, they want freedom, they want prosperity, they want opportunity. They wanted to lean toward the West, and Putin didn't want to let them go. But at the same time, I don't know to what extent, I really don't. You know, did we help foment the revolution of dignity?
Yeah.
Which you have to take a look at the result of that. It hasn't been good for Ukraine.
Right.
I mean, we're all for people, you know, fighting for freedom, but the result of that was Putin was concerned about the loss of his naval base, so he invaded Crimea, and a lot of folks in Crimea are more Russian-leaning than they are Ukrainian.
Yeah.
Invaded eastern Ukraine, which is also more Russian-leaning, and then finally invaded all of Ukraine, and the result has been massive destruction of Ukraine and the loss of tens of thousands of both Ukrainian and Russian lives.
Yeah.
That's not a successful result.
What do we
know? And we need to start understanding that. So, you know, first of all, we need to stop saber rattling. Stop beating the drums of war. do everything we can. I mean, I think it's interesting listening to RFK Jr. right now talking about his uncle and how his uncle said the top priority of any president was to keep America out of war. I think that's a pretty good priority for any president. Keep us out of war. And I will, one other point. If your listeners haven't listened to President Eisenhower's farewell address, they really should, because he covered not only warned of the rise of the military industrial complex and how that could impact us. And you take a look at what's happened since he left office in 1960. We've been in war after war after war after war.
Yeah.
Okay. And the only people really benefited is the military industrial complex, right?
Right.
But that wasn't the only thing he warned us about. He warned us about the fact that, you know, scientists are no longer tinkering on their lab bench. Now more science is being funded by government, and how that could lead to kind of a tyranny of the scientific and technological elite. You know, public policy driven by that group.
Yeah.
And I think we saw that. I would say the corruption of science, whether it's on climate change,
on COVID,
a total corruption of science in terms of medicine, the takeover of these agencies by big pharma. His third warning was about not living for today. Considering the future, don't plunder the future. Don't mortgage our children's future.
Yeah.
And the last one is he warned all society globally, don't allow yourself to fall into a dreadful state of fear and hate. So all four of the things that Eisenhower warned us about come to pass.
Well, you talk about saber rattling. Do you feel like this administration is trying to suck us into war? Because I'm sure lots of people are watching, millions of Americans, and it's like, man, it almost seems like they're doing this intentionally. You know, they keep poking the bear, as you said.
It's looking more and more like they almost goaded Ukraine into proxy war. Listen, I was at Zelensky's inauguration.
Oh.
You know, I've met him a number of times. I personally think he was absolutely sincere at making peace with Russia in terms of Eastern Ukraine and Crimea. Just making peace.
Yeah.
That's what I felt his attitude was. Something changed in his attitude.
Okay? He's not the same, huh?
And now you hear members of the administration talking about the war goal in Ukraine is to degrade the Russian military.
Yeah, openly. Apparently, I mean,
they've got 7,000 nuclear weapons. You know, one of the reasons I say we've got to bring this war to an end. Again, as much as I sympathize with the Ukrainians and their courage and their bravery of defending their, you know, again, I'm not defending Putin. I mean, he didn't have to invade.
Yeah.
Ukraine was not representing a threat to him. Okay, but I guess he was perceiving the threat. We should have taken that perception seriously. But we need to recognize that it's not a fair fight. Ukraine can't start lobbing bombs and missiles into Russia to start impacting the Russian support for the war. They got to leave Russia alone.
Yeah.
And Putin can just keep lobbing in missiles into kill citizens, destroy more of the infrastructure. And losing in Ukraine is an existential threat to Russia. He will not lose that war. If he's got to bring out nukes, I fear he'll bring them out.
Wow.
So we need to recognize that reality and bring this thing to a close, as opposed to ramping it up, giving even, you know, weapons with greater power. And I don't think we ought to be pursuing the goal of degrading the Russian military. That brings us to the brink of some kind of nuclear Armageddon.
But what do you make of Putin? Have you met him? Do you think he's crazy, or is he just calculated enough? I mean, we're talking about nuclear.
I've never met him. The highest I've ever met is Lavrov, who's a really slick character.
Yeah.
Putin is a Russian, and he's a patriotic Russian, as so many Russians are. They're proud of their country. They recognize the enormous sacrifice they've made in these wars.
You know, that's going to get you labeled as Putin sympathizer.
I'm not a Putin sympathizer. I've called him a war criminal because he's a war criminal. Okay, but we have to, in the West, start recognizing perspective of our adversaries, and we need to do everything we can to avoid war.
Yeah.
These wars just aren't working out. Now, I was just recently in Hanoi. You know, we went on a trade mission to Singapore, Thailand, and to Vietnam. And, you know, we went to their I mean, they call it the Citadel. This is where they had their underground bunkers and stuff. And they showed us videos of the bombing. They showed us what the Vietnamese did to avoid getting killed. They dug these, I don't know, about 3 or 4 foot deep pits, mm-hmm. probably about 3 feet across with a iron cover on top. And that's what, sirens go off. They'd go into there and would protect them unless it was a direct hit, basically, okay? Should we ever been bombing Hanoi? Should we have introduced how many hundreds of thousands of American troops? Should we lost more than 50,000 Americans in Vietnam?
We haven't declared. Yeah,
I'm sorry, you just have to take a look at what has happened and what the result was.
Yeah.
And if you do that, honestly, you kind of realize maybe we ought to try something different here.
And speaking of that, so we've been sending aid to Ukraine to finish this topic off, and you voted at least once to send aid to Ukraine. I think there were 3 other appropriations bills, I believe, that you voted against. Where do you stand on that? How long should we keep sending aid to them?
So you're right. I voted for the first aid package for Ukraine for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think we could have done something to prevent Putin from
invading.
First of all, very visibly giving them all kinds of lethal defensive weaponry. Mm-hmm. Say, this is not going to go good for you. The other thing would have been to publicly declare, we will never offer NATO membership to Ukraine. I told my colleagues this in one of the secure briefings we had, knowing full well that we would never take either of those actions to prevent the war. Yeah. And we didn't, and the war ensued. There might have been a moment in time when he didn't, I think Putin was probably misled by his generals thinking that they invade, they just take over Ukraine. And they were going to, let's face it, Biden offered Zelensky a ride out, which would have, I think, produced the collapse of Ukraine. But Zelensky didn't go. And that rallied Ukrainians, and they fought back fiercely. Mm-hmm. There was a moment in time, and that was about the time we were voting on that package, where maybe a public show of support from the U.S. Congress might have convinced Putin that this wasn't going to work out well, and he might have withdrawn. Okay, that one of the reasons I voted yes. The other one was, we have no control over what the commander in chief does when it comes to these types of initial wars, right? So he was depleting our stockpile of weapons, and at least $10 million, that $40 million, was to replenish our own stockpile. So that was the other reason I voted for it, but I haven't voted for one since.
So where do you stand now? Another package comes up for a vote?
They will. I'll vote no.
Okay.
Again, I'm trying to not make a big public deal of it, because again, I support the people of Ukraine. I mean, it's what Putin has done is a war crime. I mean, it's reprehensible.
They're defending their homeland. Huh?
Yeah. So you want to support Ukraine, but some way, shape, or form, this has to end, because we're not going to have a result that's acceptable to us. I mean, it won't. But every day that goes by, the end result will be less and less acceptable, because more and more Ukraine's going to be destroyed, more and more people are going to die. And I would say the same thing's true for Putin. He's not going to get a better result than if we end this thing now.
Yeah.
So at some point in time, you have to recognize the reality of the situation and act on that reality. And we don't do a very good job of that in government.
There is much more to our interview with Senator Ron Johnson. And on tomorrow's show, we will show you more of it. Stay tuned. Because on the other side of the break, we will have an interview with John Birch Society CEO Bill Hahn about taking action.
Freedom is the cure.
You're dead on. This is the largest experiment performed on human beings in the history of the world.
The more you know.
What they're doing is they're forcing vaccination on people, and I believe they are killing people with this vaccination.
The freer you are.
It's murder. They are basically murdering people in hospitals.
The all-cause mortality, we know, is now higher in the vaccinated group than the unvaccinated group.
Stay informed on the issues that affect freedom. Get a subscription to The New American today, thenewamerican.com.
Creating an informed citizenry is vital if we are to save our freedoms and our republic. But it is not by itself sufficient. If freedom is to survive and flourish, it is also imperative that enough Americans become actively involved in the freedom movement, and not just involved, but also organized. There's a column that is dedicated to making this point in each and every issue of the New Americans print magazine. It's called Taking Action. Next up, Gary Benoit interviews the author of this column, Bill Hahn, who is also the CEO of the John Birch Society. Let's watch.
This is Beyond the Cover with your host, Gary Benoit. And today, I'm delighted to have with us on this program, William Hahn, who is the CEO of the John Birch Society, and also among his many duties, the author of Taking Action, a regular column that fills the last page in the New American Magazine. So, Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Gary. Much appreciated. Happy to be here.
Well, we're so happy to have you. Now, to frame our discussion, Bill, I'd like to start with a quote from Robert W. Lee that many of our veteran members of the John Birch Society would recognize as a longtime writer. He's now deceased, but he contributed many, many articles to the New American and also its predecessor publication, American Opinion Magazine. And this is what Robert W. Lee had to say. Education without action breeds frustration, while action without education generates fanaticism. Now, Bill, I would defy anybody to read your Taking Action column and after reading it, be frustrated.
Thank you. Yeah, well, and we hope to provide, you know, more answers than we do questions, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what the what the New American has been striving to do, is to inform the citizenry on the most important issues of our day. But there has to be legs to that, right?
Yes.
And that's what the John Birch Society is all about. When you look at the organization as a whole, the organization has entities to it, the New American being one of them, and every one of our entities, our affiliates, mm-hmm. Basically are there to help support that mission. Less government, more responsibility, and with God's help, a better world. And the New American, over the years, has been with the society since day one. Of course, the one man's opinion started it all off prior to the society even being formed. Which, you know, eventually got into, the New American as of 1985. But nonetheless, we had a very good relationship with education mm-hmm. on one end, action on the other. And if you don't have those two paired together, then neither does any good. You know, and that's kind of what Mr. Lee was talking about.
Right. And, of course, one man's opinion, which started it all. Mm-hmm. That was written by Robert Welch, and he called it One Man's Opinion because he wrote the entire magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
And and of course, he went on after that to found the John Birch Society, and over time, enough people became involved with One Man's Opinion that the name was changed to American Opinion, and mm-hmm. that eventually morphed into the New American, which is, of course, today and always has been, as you say, an affiliate of the John Birch Society.
Yes.
But now, go ahead.
Now, one of the things that we look at too is, okay, so you're pairing your education mm-hmm. and action together. Let's go back in time when something like this worked, okay? So the founding fathers understood mm-hmm. that you had to have both of these. Let me give you an example. So this is a quote from John Adams in a letter to Thomas Jefferson, 1815. Mm-hmm. John Adams writes, "As to the history of the Revolution, my ideas may be peculiar, perhaps singular. What do we mean by the Revolution? The war? That was no part of the Revolution. It was only an effect and consequence of it. The Revolution was in the minds of the people, and this was effected from 1760 to 1775 in the course of 15 years, before a drop of blood was shed at Lexington." Okay? Well, what they did to effect the minds of the people was to educate them.
Right.
Okay? So in those 15 years then, if you think of the mode of communication, you know, was basically talking to folks, you know, public speaking, mm-hmm. the public opinion or the public spaces that, you know, people had, whether it was, you know, at the local tavern, at the local church, out in the town square, talking about things, having conversations, you know, with folks, and of course then having mass distribution of printed materials, which came later. And an example of that, as I wrote down here, was in 1775 with Common Sense and Thomas Paine.
Right.
Okay. Within the first 3 months, it says here 120,000 copies were sold of that.
And of course, that was a lot of copies for the time period because the population then was
about 2 million.
Yeah, 2 million.
Yeah. And if you think about it, then 2 years after that, 500,000 copies of that was sold around the world. And being in the Birch Society, we know that selling material and distributing them, or distribution of it, is actually the distribution is a lot more than the sales. So if I give you a copy of the New American magazine and I say, Gary, there's something very important here I want you to read, and I'll talk to you later about it, I'm going to give that to you, and hopefully you're reading that and you're going to give it to somebody else as well. So not only were there just, these 120,000 copies that were initially, gone through in the first couple of months, but that passed hand to hand to hand to hand to hand, right?
Right. And, of course, the patrons who were involved, they were also organized.
Yes.
And one of the groups, in fact, I believe the principal group was the Committees for Correspondence.
Yes. Matter of fact, the first one was established in 1772 in Boston. And that was so successful in disseminating information that they, replicated that throughout the colonies. So when we look at that model, okay, we look at that and we emulate that for the John Birch Society. Our committees of correspondence are our member chapters that are involved in all 50 states, okay? And so we do something similar where we ask people, we've got this important information, something that's affecting you today, whether it's your pocketbook or it's God, Family, Country. Here it is. I want you to take a look at that, and we'll follow up on a later basis, right?
Right.
That's exactly what we do. And, we don't seek the limelight, in doing this. Mm-hmm. We don't stand on the street corner and holler and scream, and the world's coming to an end. And we are very deliberate in who we approach and who we hand this stuff off to, right? And so that's what the founding fathers looked at as far as like a winning combination.
Right.
All right. You've got education, you've got action. And that action, you have to have organization behind all of that.
Right.
And that's what the John Birch Society does.
Now, even though there are great similarities between the committees of correspondence during the Revolutionary period and the chapters of the John Birch Society today, there are also differences. Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps the biggest difference, Bill, is the fact that you go back to the 1700s, the people did not have their freedoms. They did not have the means to effect change.
Right.
They were really forced to take up arms to defend their God-given rights.
Absolutely. And you will find that when you read through the Declaration of Independence, those grievances that they list in there, the initial list came from some of these committees of correspondence that were tasked with actually coming up with that, okay? And it is phenomenal to think, okay, so in these 15 years, so the revolution, the war for independence didn't necessarily just start with a drop of the hat. Mm-hmm. A bunch of people didn't just get upset and start to pick up arms and shoot at who they thought was their enemy, right? They lived within, I would consider it tyranny, for a number of years. And again, a lot of that stuff, most of it, was listed in the Declaration of Independence. You read through some of that stuff, and you will see a lot of parallels that happen nowadays with the federal government and what they're doing outside of their constitutional limitations. Again, something that I would deem tyranny.
Right.
Okay.
But of course, today, we do have our freedoms largely intact.
Absolutely.
For one thing, we still have the Constitution, and that's hugely important.
Praise God. Absolutely.
Right. And of course, I recognize, Bill, that the Constitution is constantly violated. But the point is, it's still there. We still have the Constitution. And if enough awareness is created, people have the Constitution that they can get back to. And we can still use the freedoms that we have to save our freedoms. And we can do it through educational means.
Thomas Jefferson brought up a quote. Let me read that one to you. So this is a remedy that he suggested. All right, and you're tapping right into that. So it says here, he wrote in 1820, "I know no safe depository of the ultimate powers of the society but the people themselves." Mm-hmm. "And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is to inform their discretion by education. This is the true corrective of abuses of constitutional power."
You know, Bill, that was written, of course, many years before the birth of the John Birch Society. Absolutely. But what a beautiful quote describing the whole purpose of the John Birch Society.
Right. Right, you know, absolutely. And that is what we do. We mm-hmm. deliver that education, you know, to help people understand the proper role of government, their role within it as far as what they can do regarding checks and balances, mm-hmm. right? Because if people do not get involved, then we, the people as a whole, are rather ignorant of mm-hmm. the issues and of the processes that we're supposed to be out there, you know, helping to make sure that sure. we hold people accountable.
And, of course, that's the purpose of the John Birch Society, is to provide the information. But as said earlier, providing the information by itself is not sufficient.
Right.
The information needs to be applied. And to be most effective, it needs to be applied through organizational means. And of course, your column, the last page of every edition, or print edition, I should say, the New American Magazine, makes that very point.
Right, right, exactly. And, you know, when that gets put together, mm-hmm. you know, we look at, okay, so what else is in the magazine that we can tie, you know, into? And it seems to have, you know, like some continuity to it. Mm-hmm. So when you read through the magazine, you begin to see, you know, some of these larger issues, right, mm-hmm. that are out there. And, of course, this is information that you're really not going to get elsewhere. And so you go through that, and then when you hit the last page, hopefully what I've done is help to kind of mm-hmm. wrap things up a little bit, and then to provide, you know, some opportunity for people to get involved. And what I like to do is to try to include, you know, some sort of an example that other Birchers are successfully, you know, doing mm-hmm. That provides some inspiration, you know, for others. Other times it's more, you know, getting into the principles of perhaps, you know, something that the founding fathers, you know, would have given us, mm-hmm. and then offering some solutions so that folks understand that, okay, even though there's problems out there, we know that there are so many layers of strength that the founding fathers have given us that they have put into the American system that we cannot fail, okay? I saw a gentleman the other day, you know, giving a kind of a rant on how, you know, that we shouldn't contemplate losing, right? And he's 100% correct. There's no way that we should let this country falter or fall because of the foundations of the government, right? Of the unique system of Americanism that the founding fathers gave us. We have all the tools we need to be successful. And
absolutely.
If mm-hmm. we can just understand those and embrace those and then get out there and get involved, I guess, and then to engage others with those tools, we are going to be very successful. And but of course, you know, as you well point out, it is too easy to sit back and say, this country is going to you know where in a handbasket,
right?
And we can't do anything about it.
It also might
That's
be
not true,
right? It also might be easy too for some people to recognize that there's a problem and want to do something about the problem, but not to take the time to become informed. And what happens then? And to go back to what Robert W. Lee said, there are really two things that he said in the quote that I read earlier. Education without action breeds frustration, and that's what we've been focusing on. Right. But he also said that action without education generates fanaticism. I mean, what happens, Bill, if people want to do something to save the country, but they have no understanding?
And what may happen, mm-hmm. is they may start to look to the tactics of the left.
Right.
Okay. So we look at folks that may then just go to a rally, mm-hmm. you know, start protesting and things like that. That never works for those on the right. Okay. There are so many pitfalls and traps that await you. And of course, you know, I guess we could point to January 6th as being a perfect example of that.
Oh, I think we can. And part of the problem, too, is that the left controls the cultural organs, including the media.
Very true.
And so if somebody goes in that direction, that person is displayed as an extremist by the major media.
Absolutely, yeah. So right. we love to be able to reach readers mm-hmm. and viewers, you know, of the New American Media, New American Magazine, that you know we implore all the folks out there that are listening to this, mm-hmm. That watch our videos, that actually read the magazine. And online as well to, you know, join with us at the John Birch Society at jbs.org. Sure. And really, you know, help us out to make a difference.
Of course, another problem, too, of not being properly informed is people may embrace false solutions.
That's very
for
true.
Example, term limits,
mm-hmm.
Which throws out the good guys as well as the bad guys.
Right.
And takes away from the people the franchise.
And it short circuits
or a con, a constitutional convention. I mean, why
right.
Why change the Constitution to try to make it better, you might end up making it worse instead. But why do that if the problem is a lack of understanding on the part of the people? Why not raise the understanding?
Very true. Yep, you got it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much, Bill.
All right, thank you, Gary.
And thank you for joining us for another episode of The New American TV. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. We'll see you tomorrow.